Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noll Show. And now, your host, Gary Noll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome everyone. Today, in the second part of our program, half hour from now, we'll be speaking with Dr. Rima Libeau. She is a board-certified psychiatrist, a graduate of Albert Einstein School of Medicine, and she will be weighing in on what she believes we're not open to addressing in an honest and objective way. What happens when a young person begins to take psychoactive drugs? What does it do to their personality and proclivities? If they were nonviolent before, could that put them into a mania or violent state? We'll be talking with her. Also today, some additional information on what could be causing some people, including soldiers who are killing themselves at a very, very high level, who have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, what medications they're taking, again, psych meds, that could be contributing to that. Commentaries galore today. I'm not sure I'll have time, and I'll hold mine for last, but I've written, along with Richard Gale, our executive producer and one of our scholars in residence, we have written a response to those of you who've asked, why is the American Academy of Pediatrics protecting the use of thimerosal or mercury in vaccines? Well, we decided to do an in-depth original investigative report, a white paper. It is done. It is posted. It is posted on my Facebook, on GaryNoll.com and ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com sites. It is fully referenced, but it tells you what we believe, and it's in the title. The American Academy of Pediatrics, pimping for Big Pharma, ? If I don't have time today, I will read it tomorrow. But I will read today. Reasons are changing climate is more dangerous than you think, from Tara Lohan from Alternet. A very sobering look at what's happening right now and will continue to get worse, from our environmental segment. On commentary on social issues today, an all-American nightmare, why Zero Dark Thirty, the new film, won't settle the torture question or purge torture from the American system, by Peter Van Buren, but what it means to our national discussion about violence and authorized violence. What it's like to play one of Adam Lanza's favorite video games, from Jeffrey Ingersoll from Business Insider, and some very sobering commentaries, one from George Montabat. In the U.S., mass child killings are tragedies. In Pakistan, mere bug splats, Barack Obama's tears for the children of Newton, are in stark contrast to his silence over the children murdered by his drones. And then, rounding out that discussion, Donna Mulhern from Global Research, a global perspective on American child deaths. So you see, we're going to look at these issues, but not as the mainstream media would examine them. Let us begin. And we always begin with something positive, upbeat, healing, something we can use on health and nutrition. The first study is from Science Daily. Researchers at Tel Aviv University School of Psychological Sciences found that your gut feeling, you know, intuition, alone can guide you in the right way on most of your choices. We all have gut feelings. We all will say to one another, gee, I knew I should have done that. I shouldn't have done that. I should have taken this. I shouldn't have taken that decision. And then we try to talk ourselves into a right decision. According to Science Daily, decision-making, which is an inevitable part of the human experience and one of the most mysterious, after all, haven't we for centuries been trying to figure out how we choose A instead of B, left versus right, north versus south, and how both instinct and intellect figure into the process? Here's the interesting part. Now research indicates the old truism, look before you leap, is simply not true in most cases. In a behavioral experiment, a professor Usser at Tel Aviv University School of Psychological Sciences and fellow researchers found that intuition was a surprisingly powerful and very accurate tool. When forced to choose between two options based upon instinct alone, the participants made the right call 90% of the time. The results of the study were published in PNSAS, which is a mainstream peer-reviewed journal. Even at the intuitive level, an important part of the decision-making process is the integration of value. What do I mean by that? What I mean is taking into account the positive and negative factors of each option to come up with an overall picture. Quote, "This study demonstrates that humans have a remarkable ability to integrate value when they do so intuitively, pointing to the possibility that the brain has a system that specializes in averaging values. This could be the operational system on which common decision-making processes are built." So that's good. Now, how does this relate to all of us today? Well, in my commentaries in a few moments, I'll be asking some questions of the mainstream media, our official institutions, and just lay people. Can we value all life? I'm willing to bet that 100% of people will say yes. If I ask Sean Hannity right now, or Bill O'Reilly, or even Mark Levin, do you believe that every child in the world has equal value to your own, as far as their right to be given a chance at life? I'm pretty sure that they would absolutely say yes, because they love their children, as they should. But then if I asked them, was it a tragedy all these kids killed up there in the town, they would also say yes, and they would be right. And if I then said, well, what about all the children killed through drone strikes? Innocent children. They had done no wrong to anyone. Shouldn't we be equally outraged, and shouldn't we grieve them too? Then it would no longer be intuition guiding the choice of an answer. It would then shift from intuition, which is our internal conscious truth, and it would be a conditioned response. And as a result, they would make the wrong choice and be on the wrong side of history, ethics, morality, decency. But that doesn't stop them from making that choice. And that's how smart people make stupid choices and good people make bad choices every day. No different than on a very practical level, very, very simple level. When I woke up this morning, I had a choice. Even after putting in an all-nighter on our sister station, KPFK, answering some really wonderful questions to people in the audience, I found them to be engaging and insightful, but I had to go for a workout. Did I want to go for a workout? Did I need to? I needed to, not that I wanted to. I made the choice. Why? Because I knew that stimulating my immune system, helping to strengthen my cardiovascular system, enhancing my detoxification system, creating some feel-good, de-stressing hormones, the endorphins, all would be intuitively to my advantage. So I did. In choosing a breakfast where I would put together the nutrients that my body would benefit from to keep my homocysteine levels down, or to keep my C-reactive protein down, to keep my LDL cholesterol down, my overall cholesterol down, my blood sugar down, and to keep my energy up, to give my body a chance to repair its DNA. All that was in a simple, intuitive decision. Do I want to do that? The answer is yes. How do I do it? It's simple. But what if I said, no, I'd like bacon and eggs, coffee, toast, butter, and sugar in the coffee, and some non-dairy creamer? That's not an unusual breakfast. In fact, running by a restaurant this morning on the Upper West Side of Broadway, I noticed that was on three different tables. But does a person really think that that is what their body actually needs? If on a purely intuitive level, if you gave two breakfasts side by side, one healthy and one not, but the one that was not is a part of our culture, our tradition, our tastes. We've adapted taste for that. A certain way of feeling good by smelling coffee in the morning. It wakes us up. A feeling of a crunchiness with that kind of burnt toast and that melted butter. The smell of a juicy, kind of a salty, spicy sausage. That's what the people ate where I grew up. Now, if you had both side by side, and you had a simple explanation. Here's what's the likely outcome if you eat A. Here's the likely outcome in your body if you eat B. What would our intuition tell us to do? The good foods that we may not be eating, may never have eaten, certainly not as a whole, effort, our intuition would tell us yes, our condition would tell us no. Hence again, our conditioned self almost always wins out. It's like voting for the lesser of two evils instead of finding a third-party candidate that won't win, but at least you're honoring the moral decision to vote for someone who will say the right things that are honest. Our intuition says, better to not win today, but establish the platforms for tomorrow than to go ahead and go along. That's why I say we should start paying attention to intuition and trust our intuition. And if we started to use our intuition for most of the things we do, we would do almost everything differently. The nature of our relationships. How many times do you allow someone to say something toxic and negative and demeaning to you before you finally say, that's enough? But you justify it. Okay, so they were really negative and toxic and wanted me to feel bad about myself, wanted to control me, but then they did something that was okay. So that justifies it? Your intuition says no, wrong person. But our conditioning says, well, and we go along with it. And then by the time we finally have said enough, the magic number's been reached, no more abuse, we're way down the road to having allowed ourselves to been abused. Once again, let your intuition guide you. Try it for a week, and then please report back. Let me know what changes you are making or have made based upon what your intuition guided you to do. All right? Let's just try this as an audience. Now, since our audience is all over the world, we have people right now in Ireland listening. We have people in Somalia listening, with people in Japan, China, everywhere in the world, people are listening to this program. Let me know everywhere you live a little background on how intuition versus conditioning made a difference in your choices this week. Okay? Thank you. For those of you who've ever had reflexology, where a person who understands trigger points and nerve endings in the foot, it's extremely beneficial because each part of your foot relates to a different part of your body. Like, for example, the big toe and the toes across from it will be across the top of our face and eyes, nose. I've seen people who've been congested. Their sinus is full and they can't talk, have a hard time breathing. When the ball of the foot is worked, suddenly it opens up all their sinuses. Their nose just starts running profusely, drains out their sinuses. Who would have thought that the ball of the foot would correlate to the nasal passages? But it's a fine art I suggest healing art, and I suggest that you avail yourself if you haven't. This is a study from Michigan State University. Here's what it says. And this was from a Gwen Wyatt professor in the College of Nursing. Quote, reflexology can help cancer patients. The method of massaging the feet to stimulate parts of the body can help cancer patients perform daily tasks better. The study funded by the National Cancer Institute is believed to be the first large-scale study to put hard science behind the benefits of reflexology as a complement to standard cancer care. Quote, it's always been assumed that it's a nice comfort measure, but to this point we really have not, in a rigorous way, documented the benefits. This is a first step towards moving a complementary therapy from fringe care to mainstream care. It was an 11-week experiment, and they found that when the people got regular foot massage and another group did not, and on 385 women undergoing chemotherapy and or hormone therapy for advanced stage breast cancer that had spread beyond the breast, and they said there was a big benefit there. So that's good. And by the way, them assuming that there's no other science to support alternative therapies shows their complete lack of awareness of the thousands upon thousands of studies in peer-reviewed literature supporting virtually all of accepted alternative therapy, such as homeopathy and even chiropractic, lots of it. For those of you who'd like to reduce your blood sugar, green tea can help do that. According to an article in Molecular Nutrition and Food Research, the EGCG components of green tea can reduce blood sugar spikes, especially people on a high starch diet. Quote, the spike in blood glucose level is about 50% lower than the increase in the blood glucose level of mice that were not fed EGCG, which is green tea. So if you're having a normal high starch diet, even having pasta, have yourself a glass of green tea, either iced tea or hot tea, after the meal, and it can help reduce your blood sugar. Now, following up on that, a separate study in the British Medical Journal, Open, it says, populations which drink high quantities of black tea have a significantly lower prevalence of diabetes, and that is important. They looked at diabetes in 42 nations. Quote, this is the first time that a robust statistical relationship has been established between black tea consumption and diabetes prevalence in the world. And that was according to the director of the study, a professor. A growing body of evidence points to black tea's health-giving properties. So that's important when you consider that, my goodness, we have over 285 million people in the world with diabetes, a lot in the United States, then just having a cup of black fermented tea consumption could make a difference, and we should be consuming it. It's inexpensive, it's natural, it's non-toxic, and it's beneficial. And not only does it help with diabetes, it also helps many other conditions. Now, something else that helps is your daily dose of probiotics. Here's the latest on probiotics, and this is from the American Heart Association Scientific Session. This was done at the McGill University in Canada. Here's what it says. A daily dose of probiotics may boost cholesterol management and get rid of the bad cholesterol, lower the total cholesterol, and that's good. So they're looking at what I would consider a relatively small amount of probiotics. I'm suggesting 4 to 8 billion probiotic per day. That would be about a teaspoon of liquid probiotics a day. So get your probiotics every day and help lower your cholesterol. And finally, Camu, according to the latest study, is coming up as a super food. It is 50 times the amount of vitamin C. It has 10 times the iron, 3 times the niacin, twice the riboflavin, 50% more phosphorus than oranges and other citrus fruit. It is really concentrated in nutrients, especially its phytochemical base, and its vitamin C really helps, especially in cold and flu season. And most synthetic vitamin C is simply ascorbic acid, but this is all natural and bioavailable. And so Kemu, a superfood, antiviral, fighting colds, fighting flu, anti-inflammatory, easing arthritis and other inflammatory diseases, anti-atherosclerotic, preventing plaque buildup, powerful antioxidant cell protection, antiseptic, kills bacteria, anti-mutagenic, prevents cancer-causing genetic mutations, hypotensive, lowers blood pressure, anti-ulcerous, anti-gingivitis, fights gingivitis, anti-hepatic, protects against liver disorders, and antidepressant. There are no contraindications. So, one of the things we can do, add Kemu, C-A-M-U, Kemu. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Everything that happens in life can happen in a show. You can make them laugh. You can make them cry. Anything, anything can go. The clown with his pants falling down, or the dance that's a dream of romance, or the scene where the villain is mean. That's entertainment.
I'd like to welcome all of you to this program. I'm Gary Nall. In a moment, commentaries, 5, then my guest, and then, if time permits, talk back. I will save my in-depth commentary with Richard Yale on the American Academy of Pediatrics, pimping for Big Pharma, major original in-depth investigative report for tomorrow, because I just know we're not going to have a chance to get to it. Just one quick mention. I've gotten a lot of response of people who are interested in what's coming as far the homesteading project. I will have a meeting in 3 weeks on that, because by then I'll have a date when the first of the different homestead projects, of which there are 4, will be completed, and therefore those who are interested in participating can. I am now hiring some people with unique skills. That's way out west, but in a wonderful place in one of the great states in America, where clean water, clean air, good soil, nice people, no homesteading rights they have, but no zoning, lots of good stuff going there. You know, I'm looking to add some people onto the team that's been there for a long time working, and specifically people who have expertise and background in building contractors, people who know everything from masonry to framing, roofing, all that. I have plenty of skilled individuals, but people who have overall skills. If you have that, give Jason a call. There's about 3 months worth of paid work. 646-926-5428. 646-926-5428. Don't need any just carpenters or just plumbers or just, we have all that. This is someone who has all those skills and overseeing projects. From our environmental segment, from Tara Lohan, from Alternet, I will be doing an environmental segment every single day because I believe that we have lost sight of how important our impact on the environment is. Now, this week, the sane among us will scoff at those hoarding candles and food for another apocalypse that fails to materialize. And many people laugh at the accounts of people reading about, oh, gee whiz, you know, is there a problem? Maybe we should run off to the bunkers and store our shelves. We know that the world will not come to an end in a cataclysmic end on any day soon. But here's what we're not so good at understanding. We are part of a slowly unfolding tragedy in which the end of the world as we know it may be getting closer and closer. It won't happen on any particular day that we can pinpoint, and there won't be a giant explosion or a big flood that will wipe everything away. There will be many floods and fires over many years, one species, one crop dying off after another. This may seem like a bad disaster flick straight out of Hollywood, but unfortunately, all of us have already been cast in this drama, and it's called climate change. The prognosis for heading off this the catastrophe is not great, but it's also not impossible. We don't need fear-mongering, but we do need a kick in the pants. And that's a gross understatement. We need decisive action on a scale that we've yet to see materialize. There are great things being done and wise words being written. Osher Gray Davidson has detailed Germany's rise as a renewable energy giant, and says that we can follow in its footsteps if we want. Alex Stefan believes cities will be the key to transforming our future and has presented a path for change. And Bill McKibben, who I've had on this program many times, and his 350.org have led one campaign after another to raise consciousness and fight fossil fuel giants and stop dirty energy and ignite action. But unless more of us join in their efforts and create new ones of our own, we'll be headed towards a disaster in which no amount of canned goods or personal bunkers will save us. Here are five reasons that you might want to realize that it's going to get a whole lot worse, as I've said many times. First, flesh-eating fungi. This would rank right up at one of the worst horrors you could imagine. It exists. After a powerful tornado hit Joplin, Missouri, last May, 13 people were infected with a specific type of a fungus. It's a common fungus that resides in soil and water and wood and generally leaves people well enough alone. But when it finds its way into the body, say through a blunt trauma or a puncture wound suffered in a tornado, it can grow quickly if the proper medical response is not immediately administered, and it did, and five people died from this apophysomyce. Scientists say that climate change is fueling more intense and more frequent storms, and we're seeing this play out each year in alarming proportions, and now it's bringing a whole new level of threat with it. Quote, these disasters put us at risk for exposure to organisms that are around us but don't normally cause disease. There's clearly an entire world out there that we're not seeing on a regular basis. It takes a severe event like a tornado for us to come face to face with some of the more dangerous pathogens out there, end quote. And that was from David Ingelthaler of the Translational Genomic Research Institute. Number two, endangered rivers. We hear mythic and not so mythic accounts of great floods. These days, we've come to expect them with catastrophic hurricanes and superstorms like Sandy. We've also been warned about sea levels rising, lapping at the heels of our coastal cities and vacation towns. But it's not just excessive water that may be our undoing, but the lack of it. Two of our country's most esteemed rivers have lost their might, and the ramifications of that are huge. Now, it's mid-December, and in the climate change-linked drought that plagued much of the country this summer, it's still enduring in places. The Great Mississippi is muddled with low water levels, and Suzanne Goldenberg reports for The Guardian, quote, the worst drought in half a century has brought water levels in the Mississippi close to historic lows and could shut down all shipping in a matter of weeks unless Barack Obama takes extraordinary measures, end quote. We're looking at over $4 billion impact on commerce. And the only solution at this point is shifting water from the Missouri to the Mississippi, which merely passes the problem on to Montana, Nebraska, and South Dakota. Out west, things look dire for the Colorado River and the 40 million people who depend upon it. multi-agency study says, quote, if climate change cuts into river flows as expected, doing nothing to increase supply, reduce demand, or change operational procedures leads to greater increased vulnerability to water supply shortages for Las Vegas and for the four states that comprise the Upper Basin, Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming, end quote. Well, Brett Walton for Circle Blue says, quote, if no action is taken, there is only 1 in 5 chance each subsequent year that the Upper Basin states would not be able to meet their water delivery obligations to the lower basins, according to the study. Quite simply, they'd be running out of water. Hence, you wouldn't have any water in Las Vegas. Number 3, party time. The global party has been going on for years. It started in 1992 with the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And most notable of the get-togethers was 1997 in Kyoto, Japan, when the Protocol for Reducing Greenhouse Gas Emissions was launched. This month, nations gathered in Doha for another conference of parties. At each meeting, countries agree to meet up again and again in another year and do more agreeing about the next meeting. But as far as stopping climate change, well, that's something they can't all agree upon. The U.S. never signed the Kyoto Protocol, and as The Economist reports, quote, the rich countries still signed up to Kyoto, Japan, Canada, Russia, and some others have, in effect, left it. By the way, Canada just left it this week. First time it's ever left a major treaty like this in its history. And so world leaders have hidden behind the global economic collapse as a shield, a position completely ludicrous in light of how much climate change stands to cost us. Number 4, lowballing the numbers. Here's why world leaders failing to muster any meaningful action on climate change is downright treacherous. Across 2 decades and thousands of pages of reports, the world's most authoritative voice on climate science has consistently understated the rate and intensity of climate change and the danger those impacts represent, say a growing number of studies on the topic. That's Glenn Scheer writing for the Daily Climate. Quote, this authoritative voice is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change put together by the United Nations Environmental Program and the World Meteorological Organization. But they're understating the numbers. And finally, human beings. In many ways, climate change gives us a chance to be superheroes. We don't even need anything more. The collective we have the opportunity to save humanity from a chain of unfolding disasters, despite the efforts of some stellar individuals and hardworking groups and a few sane governments, we've utterly failed thus far. Money and politics have been our kryptonite. Climate deniers, the fossil fuel industry, and the complicit politicians have obstructed progress at every turn. But in reality, we haven't fought them hard enough. If we wanted to, we could win, but we have to want to. What will spur us to action likely won't be dire predictions. No, we need a deeper societal shift in which we are able to fully understand the significance of our actions and truly care about their consequences. It'll take a kind of compassion for our fellow humans and fellow creatures that goes well beyond a helping hand in the aftermath of a storm. In tough economic times when people live day to day, we also have to think long term. But we don't. Now, to 2 short commentaries and then my guest. This is from Donna Mulhin from Global Research, titled A Global Perspective on American Child Deaths. You come from a culture where it's okay to kill children, the Iraqi woman said. We were sheltering against a wall of a building in Fallujah in April 2004. While the city was under attack by U.S. forces. I began to protest, but she continued in broken English. Let me say it another way. You come from a culture where people think it's okay to kill our children, meaning Iraqi. What could I say? There were several little bodies at my feet, bloodied remains laid out on a footpath and covered with thin sheets. The children had been shot by U.S. snipers that day, among at least 1,000 dead civilians in that ferocious battle. This Iraqi woman knew there would be no collective outrage at the killings of Fallujah's children, no front-page headlines. We would not know their names, see their faces, or hear their stories. Their killers would not be pursued, labeled mad or evil, or made to face a court. There would be no calls for change. Some commentators have compared the response to deaths of the children in the small American community of Newton with the young victims of U.S. wars. The point is valid. A life is a life, and all life is precious. A fact that has enough weight of its own without the need to draw comparisons. Yet the dark, shocking words of the Iraqi woman in Fallujah have been haunting me these past days as the grief of Newton shootings has overwhelmed us all. What might be helpful at this time is to build on this grief and passion of the U.S. and international community and allow it to shape a wider discussion, to trigger a new empathy for grieving parents everywhere, an empathy that crosses borders and which might result in change for children worldwide who are affected by U.S. policy. Whenever I've been with parents grieving their children's loss in the violence of recent wars, the same questions have emerged out of their grief and anger. How could the U.S. president feel the way he does? What would he feel if his children were killed in a bombing? How would Americans feel? How would your people feel? The question grasps at the hope that if those in the West made an effort to imagine how they might feel to lose a child violently to a drone strike, a missile, or a sniper, the result would be greater empathy and understanding. The endless heartbreaking cries at yesterday's prayer vigil for the Newton children provided a glimpse of the horror, the emptiness, the confusion the grieving parents feel. The profound love parents have for children is something all cultures have in common. In an amazing scene, Pakistani children held a candlelight vigil in Karachi in solidarity with children from Sandy Hook Elementary School. They held up a sign that read, "Connecticut school children, the killing, we feel your pain as you should feel our pain." The children were referring to the, according to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, 176 children who had been killed by U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan. Collateral damage in the war on terror. Americans now accusing the world's or the National Rifle Association of treating victims of U.S. gun massacres as collateral damage of the right to bear arms, the price that has to be paid for freedom. The deaths of the Newton children and the Pakistani children may both be the result of self-interested U.S. political policy and of all-pervasive culture violence. But there's one major difference that grieving parents in Pakistan, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Gaza would point out. The Newton killings are considered an act of someone who is sick and mad and are generally and universally condemned. But their children are killed at the hands of an intelligent, sophisticated, technologically advanced society which is fully aware of what it's doing. These deaths receive no attention and no condemnation from a president won a Nobel Peace Prize. This reality created an awkward elephant in the room during Barack Obama's passionate call for change yesterday's prayer vigil. Perhaps the grieving parents of Newton, who share the loss of parents in Pakistan and Afghanistan, can lead our president to be more compassionate. From George Montabat, from The Guardian. This is short, and we go to our guest. Mere words cannot match the depths of your sorrow, nor can they heal your wounded hearts. These tragedies must end, and to end them we must change. End quote. Every parent can connect with what President Barack Obama said about the murder of 20 children in Newton, Connecticut. There can be scarcely a person on earth with access to the media who is untouched by the grief of the people in that town. It must follow that what applies to the children murdered there by a deranged young man also applies to the children murdered in Pakistan by a somber American president. He alone is responsible. These children are just as important, just as real, just as deserving of the world's concern. Yet there are no presidential speeches, no presidential tears for them, no pictures on the front pages of the world's newspapers, no interviews with grieving relatives, no minute of prayer, no minute analysis of what happened that day. If the victims of Mr. Obama's drone strikes are mentioned by the state at all, they are discussed in terms which suggest they are less than human. The people who operate the drones, Rolling Stone magazine reports, describe their casualties as, quote, bug splats. And since viewing the body through a grainy green video image gives the sense of an insect being crushed, or they are reduced to vegetation, justifying the drone war, Obama's counterterrorism advisor, Bruce Rydell, explained, quote, you've got to mow the lawn all the time. The minute you stop, the grass is going to grow back. Like George Bush's government in Iraq, Obama's administration neither documents nor acknowledges the civilian casualties of the CIA's drone strikes in northeast Pakistan. But a report by the law schools at Stanford Law School and New York University Law School suggests that during the first 3 years of President Obama's time in office, 259 strikes, for which he is ultimately responsible, killed 569 civilians and 297 civilians, 64 children. These are figures extracted from credible reports. There may be more that have not been fully documented. The wider effects on the children in the region have been devastating. Many have been withdrawn from school because of fears that large gatherings of any kind are being targeted. There have been several strikes on schools since Bush launched the drone program that Obama has expanded so enthusiastically. Just one of Bush's blunders killed 69 children. The study reports that children scream in terror when they hear the sound of a drone. A local psychologist says that their fear and the horrors they witness is causing permanent mental scarring. Children wounded in drone attacks told the researchers that they are traumatized, too traumatized, to go back to school and have abandoned all hopes of careers that might have been otherwise there. Obama does not kill children deliberately, but their deaths are an inevitable outcome of the way his drones are deployed. We don't know what emotional effects these deaths might have on him, nor on his senior officials, because they never discuss it. 2 days before the murders of Newton, Obama's press secretary was asked about women and children being killed by drones in Yemen and Pakistan. He refused to answer on the grounds of it was classified. Classified. The signature strike doctrine developed under Obama, which is no discernible basis in law, merely looks for patterns. A pattern could consist of a party of unknown men carrying guns, which scarcely distinguishes them from the rest of the male population in northwest Pakistan, or a group of unknown people who look as if they might be plotting something. This is how wedding and funeral parties are wiped out. This is why 40 elders just sitting discussing royalties from a chromite mine were blown up in March last year. This is one of the reasons why children continue to be killed. In conclusion, Obama has scarcely mentioned the drone program and has said nothing about its killing of children. The only statement I can find is a brief and vague response during a video conference last January. Nothing more. Let's go to my guest, who is now standing by to discuss the killings and what we weren't being told and are not being discussed, Dr. Rima Libo. L-A-I-B-O. She is a medical director of the Natural Solutions Foundation. She is head of the Health Freedom USA, devoted to securing citizens' freedom of choice. She is a graduate of Albert Einstein School of Medicine. She practiced drug-free natural medicine for 35 years, and her website is healthfreedomusa.org. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Gary. I'm afraid I'd rather be talking about more pleasant topics, but this is enormously important.
You're talking on Skype from South America. I'm going to give you one question and one only, and you can take the remainder of our time to answer it, all right?
Okay.
Do you believe, or is there evidence to suggest or prove, that not only this killing, but the majority of mass killings since Columbine and before are in part responsible to these overdiagnosing and the overtreating with psychomeds by the pharmaceutical and medical community? And if that is the case, go into greater depth on what these drugs are actually doing, why we have them, and why we're not willing as a society and the medical community in particular, and psychiatry specifically, to acknowledge any of the above. The forum is yours.
Well, everything you said is correct, Gary, except for one thing. It's not the majority of school shootings and public massacres that have occurred in the United States. I am leaving out the public massacres, of course, in Pakistan and Iraq and Afghanistan and so on. Those public massacres are being done by people, 20% of whom are fighting troops, are on these psychoactive meds. But looking at the massacres in the continental United States, I guess we'd have to include Hawaii too, and Alaska, we're looking at all of the massacres being directly attributable to the use of psychiatric drugs. I want to make a point here. I am a psychiatrist. I have been a child, adolescent, and adult psychiatrist for 42 years since my graduation from medical school in 1970. And in that time, I have never written a prescription for a psychiatric drug, or in fact, although I treat people who have very serious medical conditions as well, I have never written a prescription for a medical drug. Why? It's not necessary. They're dangerous. They're incredibly toxic. The studies in what I call the paper prostitutes, the scientific journals, which are totally dependent on pharmaceutical advertising for their very survival, who use the doctors as their johns. These are journals, paper prostitutes are journals dressed up in glossy paper and sparkly words in really, really attractive visual and psychological high heels that have nothing to offer when they talk about psychiatric and other drugs except pimp information. Let me be clear about that. So these drugs are handed out more commonly than candy because most people know now that sugar is toxic. They don't yet know that these drugs are incredibly toxic, that they damage the brain, that whatever the person is put on them for, these drugs create those symptoms and more. As I said in an article which I have published on the internet in the last 24 hours called I Am Adam Lanza's Doctor. If you look at someone who is homicidal, suicidal, aggressive, violent, and they've been put on drugs that make them homicidal, suicidal, aggressive, and violent, and you don't take them off the drugs, you have no idea whether that homicidality, suicidality, violence, and aggression is due to the drug, and most often it is. These things lower the impulse and judgment levels of the brains that they are poisoning. And by the way, once you get off them, you still have very serious toxic effects. You need to detox very carefully and thoroughly if you want to get this damage undone. So I not only agree with you, Gary, with that small caveat that it's all massacres in the United States, but I also agree that there's a great deal that we don't know. The Connecticut State Police have decided and announced in a video and in writing that they will jail anyone who disagrees with the official story. And in that official story, the lone gunman is the central figure and the only figure, except for the fact that there is a police radio recording of the police talking about two other shooters running through the woods and both of them being on the ground and in handcuffs. They have disappeared. There are a good many other discrepancies, like the lone shooter, Adam Lanza, having died of a rifle wound, wearing a bulletproof vest, and that rifle wound was not possible for him to deliver to himself because he was carrying only handguns. His rifle was in the trunk of his car. So we're dealing with nasty poltergeists that shot him without discharging any bullets from his automobile. This is craziness.
I understand. Rima, those things will come out in time. The larger issue I'd like for you to address, please, and to keep our focus on is tell us now about why we have virtually no discussion upon how we end up diagnosing our children in such massive numbers as having brain chemical imbalances, address the issue of brain chemical imbalance, address the nature of the drugs. Are there any studies at all showing, legitimate studies showing safety and efficacy for all of these millions of American children using these psychiatric meds and American women using these meds? And are there any opportunities you see for the American media to bring this discussion of these meds causing this into an open dialogue?
I do not believe that the American mainstream media, which is a weapon of mass deception, will ever bring this into the mainstream until the alternative media does a thorough job, as you are doing now, as we do, at our new website, SaveMyLifeDrRima.com, and at others. I believe that it is up to us to make the point very clearly that these psychiatric drugs are chemical straitjackets which often cause the violent excesses that we're hearing about and always cause significant brain damage, long-term brain damage. I have never seen, and I read widely, I have never seen what I would call a legitimate study that shows that these drugs have any safety and efficacy profile making them worth the risk. In an emergency room, sometimes you need to do risky things to save a life, but these drugs are totally unnecessary. And as I said, I have practiced psychiatry and medicine for 42 years with very disturbed and very ill people without ever having to use them. There will never be a discussion because there's too much money, there's too much control, and let's face it, in the crumbling Chinese Empire, the British introduced opium to control the population, make it docile and dependent. We have psychiatric drugs to control the population, making them docile and dependent. I see no difference between the British East India Company's use of opium with the absolute connivance and participation of the Chinese imperial family and exactly what's happening now with psychiatric medication, which in essence separates you from yourself. And by the way, many of these drugs, like fluoxetine, are 50% fluoride by weight, and of course fluoride has a long history of being used to make people apathetic and malleable. So
okay. Dr. LeBeau, I appreciate your input. And just to reiterate, she says that there is no such thing as brain chemical imbalance. That she has never in 42 years used any of these psychiatric meds on any of her patients. She looks at the patient for other medical conditions, not a brain chemical imbalance. And that every single mass murderer in the United States was on some form of psychiatric med, and a lot of soldiers are on, and a lot of them, if not the majority committing suicide, are on them. But the media are not going to focus on that, and they're not going to open that part up for discussion, because then they would be putting themselves into a vulnerable position. They'd have to acknowledge their danger, so they simply deny it. They keep it all on the gun issue and distract from these other issues. Thank you very much, Dr. Rima LeBeau. I appreciate your input. She's just Skyping from South America. The website is healthfreedomusa.org. Now, in our final segment, and for those, I'm going to play a clip. It will run longer than what most stations have. If you want to continue listening, you can listen by calling in at 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066, or go to our website. For all the other stations that are going to have to say goodbye because we're up to our 55 minutes, we thank you for listening in, and I will be sharing Dr. LeBeau's commentary, meaning what the article that she wrote. I think it's really brilliant. I read it before today's show. And after this clip, in the extended version today, and I hope that BAI or Michael G. Haskins, some of the others, will allow this to play because it's really important for people to hear this.
Have you been diagnosed with depression and struggle with sadness?
Maybe you're scared of being criticized.
Loss of interest, aches, and pain.
I'm always thinking something terrible.
Ask your doctor about Effexorexia.
Ask your doctor about Cymbalta.
Talk to your doctor about Zoloft.
So talk to your healthcare professional.
Get your doctor
today.
Talk
to your doctor.
Tell your doctor.
Contact your doctor immediately. Doctor.
Talk with your doctor.
Over 40 years ago, leading psychiatrists met in Puerto Rico to map out their vision of the future.
We see a developing potential for nearly a total control of human emotional status, mental functioning, and will to act.
Their plan? To create by the year 2000 a range of psychiatric drugs regulating every aspect of human behavior.
I was diagnosed with depression and put on Paxil.
ADD, and I was prescribed Ritalin.
General anxiety disorder. Prescribed Zoloft.
Bipolar disorder, and I take lithium.
PTSD, Zoloft.
I was on Paxil.
And they placed me on Zoloft.
They gave me Adderall.
I was prescribed Siptimil.
Tegretol.
Lexapro. Devico.
Stelazine. Adderall.
Concerta. Lorazine.
Prozac. Lorazepam.
Epixel. Clonazepam.
Ritalin.
Dexamphetamine.
Paxil.
Xylert.
Prozac.
Adderall.
Elavil.
Depakote. Wellbutrin. Seroquel. Etc.
100 million people worldwide are on psychiatric drugs. How did this happen? Psychiatrists convinced them they were sick.
They want you to think you're diseased from birth, and that all those experiences of life, childhood and adolescence and teenage years and adulthood, being a senior citizen, that these are all various stages of disease.
Because let's face it, we've all been depressed at one time. We've all been anxious at one time. These are normal emotions that we feel.
Every emotional and spiritual problem is reduced to a label.
And of course, all of those diseases require pharmaceutical treatments. This is big, big business.
While generating a healthy income, claiming to be medical professionals, psychiatrists will freely confess that their profession is devoid of science.
Well, you don't really have any specific blood tests or other tests that are definitive for any mental illness whatsoever.
It would be neat if it would become much more scientific.
Well, if you go to my office and you tell me that you're depressed, there's nothing, and no blood sample, whatever, no tests.
There are not current available tests to verify your diagnosis.
I don't use any tests.
You do not have a test to say, well, this is this disorder, and this is the best medication for this disorder.
For many years, we thought we had the tests nailed down, but it turned out that they weren't of any value.
If you don't know what's causing the symptoms, then to give somebody something to alleviate the symptoms is close to impossible.
By the time a drug's approved and it hits the general population, we don't know even 50% of the side effects that are involved with that drug.
And these pills cause heart attacks and liver problems and immune system problems and lots of other medical problems. So you're playing with fire.
Every day, psychotropic drugs cause serious adverse reactions. And while psychiatrists and drug companies fully understand the dangers of the drugs they sell, their unsuspecting customers are left to suffer the consequences.
Everything became worse. Each mood swing was worse.
He would have chronic headaches, chronic, nausea, not feeling good.
She was very agitated, very, very jumpy.
She was having horrible hallucinations.
Her personality was disintegrating.
Once he started on that drug, he just...
All of the people you just heard were outside of the American Psychiatric Association convention. You'll see all these in my new documentary. When interviewed, is there any evidence whatsoever in the world that there's a chemical imbalance, or do you have any objective criteria for diagnosing anyone with bipolar or anything? You heard the psychiatrist there from all over the world say no, 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 no. All the people that you just heard, their kids end up killing themselves. More on an upcoming program. Finally, today we'll close out our program with Dr. Rima LeBeau's letter. I am Adam Lanza's doctor. I have treated Adam Lanza, male and female, young and old, for decades. I'm a child, adolescent, and adult psychiatrist. I've treated autistic people of all ages, Asperger's syndrome people, schizophrenic people, bipolar people, multiple personality disorder people. I've treated them all. Graduated from Albert Einstein School of Medicine. I've never written a prescription for a psychiatric drug or any other type of drug for that matter. I have while serving as the acting director for a child and adolescent psychiatric ward of a large hospital not very far from Newton, Connecticut, looked at a drug-disoriented, drooling, and dangerous child in my care and other children ranging 4 to 16 and taking all of them at that moment on psychiatric medications, weaning them off carefully was my job, because I'm there not to give psychiatric medications. And I could not tell what we were dealing with other than drug-damaged brains and bodies of the young and the very young kids I had to care for. The nurses told me I could not do that because they could not contain the children. The nurses told me I had to pay attention to them and ask me, then, did they know about the children who were violent, homicidal, and suicidal, were all on drugs known to make them violent, homicidal, and suicidal? They told me that I could not do that. I couldn't do what I knew I could do and help the children. And they complained, and I complained right back. And I won that day. I got them off their meds. Now, a four-year-old on 11 different psychiatric medications, 4 years old, 11 different psychiatric medications, who was toe-tapping, a sign of neurological damage in a four-year-old, who wanted to die, stopped drooling and spinning around in circles when she came off the meds. I was the first person to ask her why she had plunged a knife into mommy's boyfriend's leg when he was asleep. She told me he was hurting me down there, pointing to her vagina. Every night, mommy would not stop him. When the event occurred, she was medicated without a single person taking a moment to ask why the act had taken place. You see, I'm old enough to have learned my craft and art before the advent of untested, highly profitable, and totally unconscionable psychiatric drugs. I read the literature on these neurological poisons and saw that the long-term studies were absent, that the pediatric studies were absent, that the advertising-supported impartial journals were nothing more than paper prostitutes all dressed up in paper dresses and glossy ads. I watched in horror as younger and younger children were placed on stronger and stronger drugs for less and less indication. I learned orthomolecular medicine, psychiatry, it works. I learned how to listen and move people towards emotional health. That works. I learned how to employ neurobiofeedback to teach the brain how to regulate itself and the body in harmony with its capacity and needs. That works fantastically well. I learned how to use frequency medicine, homeopathy, herbal medicine, intravenous nutrition, and a variety of other modalities which actually support healing. They work. I learned how to use diet and detoxification, which I learned in environmental medicine. It works. What does not work is drugging the brain with toxins which create the very symptoms for which the drugs were given in the first place. I have met and held Alan Lazonda's mother in my arms as she wept in fear and exhausted despair. And I've held her in my arms as she wept for the joy of having her child clear-eyed and of a sound mind, not in moments of quick hope, but continuing and consistently. I've held Adam Lanza's mother's hand in court as we pressured his school to give him the education he needed, not the one that they had made money on from destructive state subsidies for the corrupt diagnosis of another drug kid. I have sat with Adam's brothers and sisters, helping them to undo the trauma that Adam on drugs has brought to their lives. Adam Lanza and I have spent hours together as he climbed out of the pit of his own psychosis without drugs, confinement, or violence, but not necessarily smoothly either. And I have attended the funeral of more than one Adam Lanza whose family pressured his mom, or whose divorced parent pressured the custodial parent through the court to put Adam on drugs, and then did not even have the good grace or decency to accept responsibility for his death. We know of absolutely no chemical imbalance to account for mental or emotional illness. We know that genes are disrupted, so function is distorted by a host of causes, chief among them which are heavy metals like mercury and industrial poisons like formaldehyde, fluoride, and foreign DNA, and proteins which call forth an autoimmune reaction and cause neurological disruption. This is the type of expression of a large-scale disability I have called genome disruption syndrome. It is not a genetic drift that accounts for the changes in the human genome, which are linked to increased cancer rates, autism, increased diabetes rates, and other chronic degenerative diseases, which were virtually unknown in our grandparent and parents' childhoods. The genome is the same. The genomic disruption is by no means the same. I must presume that this Adam Lanza was not only medicated, or had recently discontinued his medications with psychiatric meds, but was also vaccinated. So this Adam Lanza was toxic with thimerosal, formaldehyde, fluoride, MSG, foreign DNA, lipoid cells, foreign proteins, polysorbate 80, and other synthetic toxins injected into his body, regardless of their toxicity and regardless of his ability to remove them from his body. So this Adam was, in my supposition, if it's correct, neurotoxic. His mother, I must also presume, had no intent to harm him when she allowed his genome to be repeatedly overwhelmed with unnecessary and dangerous vaccines, and then similarly with dangerous and unnecessary psychotic and psychiatric medications. No, I am sure that she followed the perhaps well-intentioned advice of experts who themselves have suspended their capacity to evaluate data, instead rely on the herd belief that, since it is said so often, the safety and efficacy of the drugs and vaccines pervade so beautifully in the journals and ads, seminars and training, complete with pizza and salad during a busy lunch in a windowless conference room or in a clinic, must be safe and effective. They are neither, and Adam Lanza and their mother and sisters and brothers and fathers and neighbors, and today his grieving neighbors, Newton, Connecticut, can testify to that. There is a time to say no. That time has arrived. No to psychiatric drugs. No always is a better way. More than half of the people who kill themselves are on psychiatric drugs. No to vaccines. There could be no worse way. Virtually every modern outbreak of epidemic takes place in the fully vaccinated, to which the vaccine pushers retort, well, people give more vaccines, maybe it wouldn't be having a problem. No to GMOs, which are likewise altering our very genome. Psychiatric drugs kill both those who take them and those they turn on. They are necessary and dangerous, but oh, so profitable. Rima LeBeau. I'm Gary Nall. That completes our program. Thank you very much for listening. Now we'll go over to Utrice Lead. Sorry for the delay, Utrice. Had to get
Not
this
at
in.
All. It was well worth it. Quite an education there.
We look forward to your program, Utrice.
Thank you.
Saw you look quite so pretty before. Never saw you dress quite so handsome. What's more, I could hardly wait to keep our date this lovely Easter morning, and my heart beat fast as